I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Michael Callahan. Michael has been fortunate to create customer experience strategies for three iconic brands, Microsoft, Amazon, and Hulu. Solutions he has designed have won patents, and his team's work continues to touch millions of customers around the world every day. Michael is now the director of the Global Customer Experience Practice for Blueprint Consulting Services and leads a team in Venice Beach, California. The team advises C-level executives on customer experience strategies. They build bleeding-edge analytics, tools to give leaders insight that drive change, and they perform world-class customer research. Michael is passionate about ending youth homelessness and lives in Venice with his two dogs, Teague and Flynn. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have a really interesting background, and you've worked with some really world-class organizations, and I wondered if you could start by talking a little bit about your journey and kind of why you've pursued the path that you have.
Absolutely. Yeah, I began my what I call my grown-up career at Microsoft in 2005, supporting what was then an absolutely iconic brand, which was Hotmail, with its 400 million customers in 36 countries speaking 16 languages. It was just an absolutely transformative experience for me because I got to marry my passion for customer service with Microsoft's deep engineering capabilities and very broad marketing capabilities. So that really was the first time where I felt like I fit into a broad technology landscape. Really enjoyed my time at Microsoft, and in 2011 I had an amazing opportunity, which was to become the first digital customer experience manager for Amazon in advance of them launching the Kindle Fire tablet, which really sort of changed the world in terms of consumer entertainment on mobile devices, along with the iPad in 2011, to build out a role and to define customer experience for a company like Amazon was extraordinary.
So at that point, Amazon was already a big name.
They were absolutely a big name in retail, and they were definitely the standard bearer for the e-reader. But Amazon's digital products, Amazon Instant Video, Amazon's App Store, their MP3 store, were actually quite small relative to the market and were not even very well known inside of Amazon. So we, over the two-year period that I was there with Amazon and Instant Video in particular, grew extraordinarily in the 2 years that I was there. We went from sort of an unknown competitor to Netflix to being in the conversation today that people have around. It's an Emmy-winning television, very well-known shows that it's producing of its original content, and it streams some of the most popular TVs and movies on the planet.
What does it feel like to be the first one in a seat like you have had?
You know, it's an interesting experience for me, and I was familiar with it a bit, but the reality is that when you put in a new role, especially one that can be perceived as creating distance between two organizations, and in this case it was Amazon Customer Service, was struggling to keep up with the engineering appetite of Amazon Instant Video, for instance. Amazon Instant Video wanted to move rapidly forward on a lot of device platforms, and Amazon Customer Service wasn't quite ready to move that rapidly. And my job was to help customer service become agile enough that they could land and support platforms in very quick fashion. But there was definitely a perception that I was a wedge that had been inserted in between customer service and engineering, when my job was really to make that relationship even more powerful than it had been. So there's definitely a deep need for influence and for developing cross-team collaboration in an experience like that. But it was absolutely interpersonal challenges and helping people understand that I was actually there to raise everybody's game, not remove people from the game.
Yeah. So often the first person in a new role can be perceived as a threat to the status quo to a lot of people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I learned that at Microsoft, because my job at Microsoft was to drive disruptive innovation into established but not necessarily extremely successful support organizations. So when I showed up, the team that I was showing up to help knew what my role was, and that my job was to help struggling teams be successful. So I was somewhat used to that, the idea that people looked at me with a cocked eyebrow when I came into the room, and I think that really helped me at Amazon. I think rather than it taking 12 months or more for me to develop influence and partnerships, it took me about 6 months.
I wonder if you would be willing to share a story or an example of how you overcame that fear of your being a wedge.
Yeah, absolutely. So we instituted, when I was at Amazon, we instituted essentially an idea garden, if you will. I'll use that phrase for now. I won't use the name of the program at Amazon. But the point of the idea garden was to allow any employee in the company to submit ideas about improving product policy or process, and specifically with regard to my digital product, so video, app store, music. And we knew that we had an issue in the Amazon Instant Video in the way the purchase experience went that we were planning to fix. We had some ideas around how to fix, but an idea came through the idea garden that was actually improved the plan that we had to fix this feature in Amazon Instant Video. And the idea was attached to two employees at a call center in Kennewick, Washington. And I really just championed them and their idea through to the resolution, getting the bug fixed in the product. Even though we'd had the idea, we knew what we were going to be doing, but I loved the idea of attaching two folks from a call center to an idea that I knew would be implemented, and really celebrating their creativity and innovation. And it was a small gesture. It didn't require a lot of effort or change on my part, but it was really about being a silent partner to the teams and letting their ideas and creativity flourish, and me being sort of the messenger to deliver things and taking the spotlight off of me and focusing it on the folks in the front line in particular, whose attitude and whose their perspective on how important they are and how valuable their voice is influences our relationship with customers. So it was very important for me to make sure that they felt like they were participating in the experience.
Yeah, so this is really a great example of how you foster a collaborative culture.
Yeah, it starts with humility. And I think that's definitely a lesson for me. I have an ego like everyone else does. And I really, it really became about that the ideas were getting implemented and less about that it was my idea or someone else's idea, and really stepping aside and facilitating and being really delighted with the fact that I could facilitate an outcome, and much less stressed about whether my name was attached to the outcome.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And I hope our listeners are paying attention, because this is really such a great lesson. There's so many people don't focus on humility and don't think about giving first before looking at what they can get out of a situation.
Yes, it's a. I think I learned it. You know, there's a great story at Microsoft where we had a very bruising battle. Not that anyone didn't want to do the work that we had asked. It was a matter of timing and resources. And we, in Microsoft customer service, felt passionate that we needed to address a feature issue in a release. And it was a bruising. You know, it's one of those coming down to the 11th hour. Which way is it going to go? And we got the work into the code and into production on the schedule we wanted. And I think it was all of our inclination to say, we won today. We won the battle. And what I said to the team was, the announcement that we sent out was, the engineering team made a great decision on behalf of customers today. And we're thrilled for that. Everybody won in that situation. And I didn't need to create a winner and a loser internally. The winner was really the customer, and I think those are really important choices to make on the path toward true teamwork and collaboration.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Michael, so then you went on to from Amazon to Hulu.
I did. I became the executive in charge of customer service at Hulu in 2013. I never really dreamed about leaving Amazon, but it was too much of an opportunity to lead my own organization and also to be a part of an executive team of a absolutely fiery hot brand.
And so what were things like when you first arrived at Hulu?
Well, I think charitably, you know, the organization was a little bit lost, and I don't think that that was anyone's intention. The reality was that the team that had started up Hulu by and large had left by the time I arrived in June of 2013. Hulu was up for sale. Its owners, who were the media partners at ABC, Disney, NBC, and Fox, had put it up for sale. When I got there, unbeknownst to me, there was allegedly they were within days of selling to a buyer. And there was definitely, although there's incredible pride in the culture at Hulu, even in down times, people are remarkably proud of the organization and the brand that they work for. There was definitely a sense that we had lost our way a bit. And by the time I finished the summer in August of 2013, all but two of the original executives had left Hulu, so we were essentially without a leadership team.
What was that like?
Well, it was jarring, in a way, to sort of realize you had joined a boat and a mission that was unclear the direction that you were going to head. But in a way, David, it was also actually very freeing, because my organization, customer service, had an incredible amount of growth to accomplish. We needed to develop operational fundamentals that were missing at the time when I arrived. We needed to work on performance and quality, our relationship with customers, our tool set. Everything required work and effort. And it actually allowed me to sort of turn the focus of the organization away from the corporate direction and the leadership that wasn't in place yet, and have us really focus internally on our own vision, mission, and values. So it was nerve-wracking to be leaderless for a little while, but it was also freeing in that we could only focus on what was in our control, and it allowed us to make really extraordinary progress in a very short amount of time.
So what were some of the results?
Well, we went from a poor performance from a customer perspective in terms of sheer waiting for a customer service associate. We were very, very not meeting our service level goals by any stretch of the imagination. We had emails that were days, if not weeks, out of compliance with the service levels. Customers were waiting for extraordinary length times on the call queue to get to us, and we turned that around after getting fully staffed and getting some workforce optimization to having, you know, 95% of calls answered in 15 seconds, which is what I would consider to be a world-class service level. We also implemented a new customer quality measurement called the Customer Experience Index, and that achieving an 85% in the Customer Experience Index is a really terrific score, and we were operating in the mid to high 80s for our customers measuring the quality of the experience. We also implemented new scheduling, new shift management. We allowed virtual employees to work for us, which opened us up to a lot of candidates who weren't willing to make a commute to West Los Angeles every day through the Southern California traffic. And we also developed a voice of the customer scorecard that we use to influence change and to keep the executives aware of what customers were actually thinking of us, which in a time of upheaval and leadership transition and, you know, things like that, unfortunately, one of the people you take your eye off of in those moments is the customer. And so the voice of the customer allowed us, as a new leadership team came on board, it gave us a single venue through which we could talk about customer frustration and customer opportunities. So It was a very busy 15 months while we got the new leadership team into place, but it was a very productive 15 months as well.
What would you say are some tips that you could share with our audience, or some keys to being able to grab hold of this, of the customer experience, and really make some significant changes? Well, it sounds like the company was going through some major growing challenges.
It was, absolutely. And I think my first piece of advice that I had to learn a few times over was keep it simple. Focus on one thing at a time. And it doesn't have to be a big rock that you're moving. It can be a smaller rock to demonstrate to everyone that you and your team are capable of moving that rock. I think we have a tendency to try to do too much. I think we have a tendency to try to do too much too quickly. And I think it's important to stay laser focused and resilient on accomplishing one objective at a time, pausing, celebrating that you overcame that obstacle, pausing and reflecting on what you learned in the overcoming of that obstacle, and then signing up for the next obstacle. So I think it kept the team very focused. We were sort of religious about we're gonna knock down that rock is coming first, and here's how we're gonna do it. Here's who's gonna lead it. Here's who's gonna support it. We celebrate it, and then we move to the next one. So I think staying focused, number one, is really important. And I think number two for us, what was absolutely critical was data. We had a lot of storytelling. I love storytelling, but storytelling without data is just, it's not a very effective way of creating change. And we absolutely lacked critical business insight. And one of the first things that I put into place was an analytics team who could really put data behind the decisions we made so that we would understand when we moved that rock, what was going to happen. So I think staying focused is number one. I think being very data driven is number two. And number three, particularly in a chaotic environment, pausing to really celebrate individual and team achievement is absolutely critical, because we had a tendency to originally say, okay, push that rock. Who's next? What rock should we push next? Instead of really calling out the contributions of the people who made the rock move.
Yeah, celebrating wins is really important.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting. I got the opportunity to work with a lot of millennials at Hulu. Much of the customer service organization were in their early to mid-20s. And it was really interesting that we had to really pause and allow people to let the praise and the recognition wash over them, because they had a tendency to feel discomfort with getting recognized that way, which I found interesting. And they wanted to move quickly past the recognition. And I sort of forced everyone, often in uncomfortable silences, to say, no, you're going to stand there and receive the praise because you deserve it, and let us acknowledge the great contribution that you made. And it is important, and it's something we speed past, I think, too often.
Yeah, particularly when you're talking about a company or an organization that's going through rapid growth. Everybody's in a hurry.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if you're in an industry where there's a lot of change, like technology, there's also a tendency to try to move too quickly.
Yeah, the reflection, the chance to be thoughtful, it seems less and less likely that you can be thoughtful in a world where we so rapidly iterate, and we move to the next challenge. And I see that in my consultancy, that people want the solution, you know, in 15 days or less. And sometimes I think we need 15 days just to contemplate the solution. So the collision of that wanting to be thoughtful and reflective with the rapid decision making and just product iteration, the way products are released now and updated now, there's a collision there that I think happens, and I wish we would be more reflective and thoughtful, inject a little bit more of that into the speed to market sort of mindset.
So talk to me a little bit about the consulting work that you're doing now.
It's incredibly fun. my team and I do three things. We obviously help teams do customer service strategies. That's sort of in my wheelhouse from my 25 years of experience. But the area that we're really focused on is customer experience. And for folks who aren't really familiar with that, that customer experience is really just the sum total of the journeys your customer goes on with you through their lifetime as your customer. The discover you journey, the free trial, you know, try you out without paying journey, the I'm going to become a paid member or a subscriber journey, the how do I consume more of your services and how do I learn more about what you do journey, and then ultimately the I'm going to leave you or I'm going to stay with you forever journey. So we help companies map those journeys and really walk them in their customer's shoes. And that is toward a goal of, you know, typically a C-level executive has come to me to say, we're not achieving one of our highest level business objectives. And I've given the team three turns at the bat, and we haven't moved the needle on this goal. Let's say it's a retention goal. They want to keep more customers than they lose. And they will come to me and the team and say, can you help us? And we come in and understand the core journeys that impact retention. How do customers decide whether they're going to stay or go? And it really is both a very human exercise in that you are really walking as though you're the customer, but it's also a deeply analytical exercise because you need to have really great data and research about the decision points that customers face and why they may make a I'm quitting you decision versus I'm staying with you decision. We also build just amazing what we call the customer insight engine, which is a real-time dashboard that is capturing the data from those journeys in real time. And it's an extraordinary piece of technology that I love rolling out because we get aha moments every time we roll it out to a customer.
Yeah, I find that it's way too common for companies not to be in sufficient touch with their customers about their motivations and their behaviors. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about some of the pitfalls. Where do companies miss the mark with regard to understanding what drives customer experience?
Sure. Well, I think one is when you think about a customer journey, like, you know, someone's first experience with you. If you were the designer of that experience, you know, you own the homepage or the front page of the app, and you're the customer support guy who supports that experience, you tend to take for granted that the experience works the way you designed it, and you don't walk through the experience as your customer would, and really do the work of walking through that experience. On a weekly basis, I walk companies through customer journeys, and they are never not surprised by how complicated or how effortful the journey is. So I think you must commit to walking in your customer's shoes on a really regular basis, number one. Number two, I think that companies tend to be very afraid of the emotions behind customer behavior because it's messy. Humans we're messy people. We have complex emotions. But the reality is, and the research really backs this up, is that the emotional perspective of a customer is largely the determinant behind their future behavior. So if you're trying to figure out how a customer will behave after going through a negative or positive experience, you've got to be willing to embrace their emotional perspective. And it's hard to measure, but it's getting better. There's actually high motivating emotional attitudes that are directly linked to customer behavior. So if customers feel that they can trust you, even if they've gone through a negative experience, but they come through that negative experience feeling that you treated them fairly and that you had their best interests in mind, they will largely have a very strong, positive emotional attitude toward you. And that emotional attitude will not only drive them to trust you more, which means that they'll try your new products and services more freely than a brand new customer will. They'll forgive you in that new product experience if it's not as perfect as you'd hoped it would be. And they will recommend you to other people based on that, their trust of you. So I think, you know, one is really walking through customers' journeys in their shoes. Two is really understanding the behavior behind customer emotions. And three, I think people are simply looking at too much data. I was on a client site a few weeks ago, and they walk through a 45-page scorecard every week. And I observed and noticed that absolutely no action came out of it. They just read the scorecard, and this is an executive team. It's a well-paid team. And they spent 2 hours walking through a 45-page scorecard and did nothing. We're turning that 45-page scorecard into five key metrics. Those five key metrics have owners. Those owners have goals and accountability. And there are quarterly cadences around addressing deficiencies in each of those five key metrics. So there's a very rigorous structure put around that, but I got a great deal of resistance when I said we're going to toss the 45-page scorecard and you're going to focus on five metrics. But they're the right five metrics that reflect the health of the company. And I think there's just a little bit of discipline lacking. It feels as though more data is better to look at than less data, and I don't think that's right. I think it's looking at the right data.
As you said earlier, it's really important to keep things simple.
Absolutely.
And yes, we all know that emotions sell. So understanding the emotional mindset and the motivations and behavior of the customer based on emotions is really important.
Absolutely.
So Michael, what's new and exciting that you're working on now?
You know, I think it's the data plus emotions, actually. It's interesting that we landed on that conversation, but I think there's a emerging school of data analytics that is actually quantifying and stratifying customer emotions into categories, and then understanding what companies need to do if they want to achieve a particular emotional relationship with a customer. There's some great work reflected in the most current version of the November issue of the Harvard Business Review that really talks about how to quantify emotional attitudes and how they relate to behaviors.
It's fascinating. Yeah, I'm not sure that that somebody would necessarily think that you can quantify emotions.
It's a challenge, and I think the exciting part about it to me is that we're at the very beginning of this conversation, and so it can only get better and more informed as we go. So I'm really excited to be part of that discussion. I think it's incredibly valuable, and I think when you look at the numbers in terms of the financial outcome for companies, it's a no-brainer to start to think about your relationship to customers based on their emotional perspective and attitude toward you.
So with that in mind, I wonder if I could ask you a little bit about who has influenced you in your professional development, in your career, because this understanding of the customer mindset is really an interesting one.
For sure. I would say probably the single most influential person that I've worked with in the last 5 years in particular is Kerry Bodine. Kerry is the author of Outside In, which is really the Bible of putting the customer at the center of your business conversation and working from there. She's a consultant out of San Francisco now. We talk on a semi-regular basis, and she put the work in to show the profitability around customer centricity. And she has extraordinary use cases, many, many well-known brands and Outside In that you'll all recognize, who, when they put the customer at the center of their business decisions, achieved extraordinary profitability, which I think people sort of believe is that can't happen. But actually, it happens more and more frequently than people would imagine when they put the customer at the center of that. So Kerry is on my mind on almost a daily basis. I try to stay aligned to her philosophy and her guidance.
That's a great example. And along the same lines, who do you know personally who is currently doing remarkable work?
You know, there's a great team. There's a technology team at Blueprint, which is my parent company. They're not down here in Venice. They're up in Bellevue, Washington, and there's a data analytics team that is working on some predictive analytics. literally helping companies change the future by measuring the present. And they're doing some mind-blowing work. Just to watch the stuff that's coming out of that team is absolutely fascinating and very, very exciting. I'm new to predictive analytics. I've just started dabbling in it. And so to see technology built on machine learning and analytics capabilities is just thrilling.
It's a great example. Michael, how can listeners learn more about you and the work that you're doing?
I am proud to be part of Blueprint Consulting Services, so you can visit www.bpcs.com for our corporate website. I write frequently on my own blog, which is at www.michaeltcallahan.com. And if anyone would like to reach out to me individually, I'm happy to answer questions and hear the challenges people are facing at michael@bpcs.com.
Great, great. We'll include those in the show notes. And it's been great speaking with you today about customer experience, about your own experiences, and the ups and downs of all kinds of business challenges. So thank you for being a guest today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Michael Callahan, the director of the Global Customer Experience Practice for Blueprint Consulting Services. Thank you again, Michael, for joining us.
It was my pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.